Okay, Michael, alcoholic. Okay, now we're going to pick up on self-pity. I can tell you, the way I do the steps is the way Dr. Bob took people through the steps. And in the big book, it's on 261, the last line on 261, and it goes up onto 262, is Earl Treat. And it talks about him going through the steps with Dr. Bob. And there were only six steps at that time. And the moral inventory was oral. But at the moral inventory, they went over personality defects at great length because they really did believe you'd drink over those defects. They said the seventh-step prayer together, only it wasn't known as the seventh-step prayer. And then the sponsor helped you with your list of amends to make. Now, Bill wanted to stretch those steps into 12 for spiritual reasons. And so he took those three actions that they always did at the moral inventory, gave him numbers, and just threw them in the book. And 6, 7, 8, and the beginning of 9 are all on one page. So there's very little in the big book on those steps. And, well, on 9, there's a lot on step 9. But step 6 in the 12 and 12 is probably my favorite step in the 12 and 12 because it's just, what it says is God will not render you white as snow without your cooperation. It says the man that repeatedly worked on his other defects of character grows in the image of his creator. It doesn't say you have to master him or get over him. It just says repeatedly works on him. And then he addresses the fact that some of our character defects are natural instincts that have gone amok. And there's no way God can remove a natural instinct. He gave them to us for survival. So Bill says sometimes we might have to settle for patient improvement. And that would be something like compulsive overeating, greed, seven deadly sins, or, you know, there's certain things that fear. When you're asking God to remove fear, you don't want fear removed. You want unhealthy fear removed. I mean, fear of drinking is a very healthy fear. You know, fear of somebody standing there with a knife, healthy fear. So we want the unhealthy fear removed, not fear in general. That's a natural instinct. But anyway, so on self-pity, one sip of this fairly slow-acting emotional intoxicant can lead to distorted perspective. Giant mountains mushroom out of little tiny molehills. Problems are magnified and calamities loom on all sides. The drunkenness progresses to the crying stage and the dialogue runs. Nobody loves me. Nobody appreciates me. Nobody cares. Nobody recognizes how hard I try. Somebody is against me. All the time there's somebody against me. I might as well be dead. Set to a mournful tune, these lines are played over and over in a half-dark, gloomy, and unswept mental hangout. At the center of self-pity is a half-grown kid having a slobbering, blubbering temper fit at God. Self, circumstances, and people. As long as he can keep the drunk tears flowing, he does not have to leave and go out into the light. Solution. Hourly doses of daily gratitude. Appreciation and admission of God's grace. Stop hanging out in mental dumps. Stop keeping company with the bad companies of resentment, fear, and selfishness. Don't flirt with self-justification or self-righteousness, which will sweet-talk you into a dive. Total abstinence is hardly possible unless the self-pity trips are replaced with being others-centered. Substitute daily contact with the higher power and group members for their frequent visits to the self-pity bars. So, self-pity was a real big one for me. I mean, if you had my childhood, I mean, my self-pity is justified. Look at my childhood. You know, I'm illegitimate. My mom prostituted and drank and was always gone. I mean, It was really pathetic. Slipped in cars. I think my self-pity is justified. Anyway, my sponsor, I did my step six with her, and we listed all these character defects, and she asked me, what do I think is my biggest character defect? What was interfering with my life the most? And I looked over that list, and I went, stealing, maybe prostitution, made me feel real bad about myself. And she said, that doesn't even come close. She said, your main character defect is self-pity. And she said, pour me, pour me, pour me another drink. And so I got to work on self-pity on a daily basis, which I still do today. Every day I do a gratitude list. And there's always things to be grateful for, always. There might be problems. There's always problems. But there's always things to be grateful for. And if you put your thoughts into gratitude, it just improves your attitude. Attitude of gratitude is what this gentleman used to say. There is a man named Hal Marley. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of him. He was a speaker, and he came from the Washington, D.C. area. He had he was a high official in the government. And in Daily Reflections, which is written by alcoholics, he wrote February 24th, and it's called A Grateful Heart. And he talks about having an attitude of gratitude, and he talks about being grateful for three things. He's grateful for AA, he's grateful for his sobriety, and he's grateful for that he's alive, and just other things. And it's just really a neat, it's always been my very, very favorite reading in the 24-hour book, not the 24-hour, the Daily Reflections. So the first time I spoke with him, he said enough in his talk that I knew he wrote that. And I went up to him and I asked him, I said, how did you write February 24th? And he said, yes, I did. And I've got to tell you, he died a few years ago. And what day did he die on? February 24th. And to me, I mean, nobody got it. And I got a call from this woman. She said, Hal died yesterday. And because that was my favorite day, I'm really aware of it. And I went, are you sure? She says, of course I'm sure. I went, he died yesterday? And she goes, yes. And I went, oh, my God. That's the day he wrote in Daily Reflections, February 24th. And so to me, he was telling all of us that he died with a grateful heart. So, hourly doses of gratitude, appreciation, and admission of God's grace. I really recommend you do gratitude lists every day. I know some people just write five things. I mean, you can write five, you can write 10, you can write however many. But start looking at the things that you're grateful for. Take the focus off of the things you're not grateful for and put your focus on the things you are grateful for. And it does change your attitude. It's acting your way into right thinking. Another thing I do, not just dealing with self-pity, but when I'm into being intolerant of other people, I always look for the good in them. I'll sit there and I'll try and look for the good points. Purposely sit down, and even if I have to write it out, look at the things that are good about them to take my focus off the things that I hate about them. Not hate about them. I don't hate people today. I just don't hang out with some of them. No. Okay, resentment. Practice acceptance is one way of ridding yourself of resentment. Forgiveness, willingness. An emotional intoxicant instilled from character defects, guaranteed to impede progress in steps 3 and 11. Drinking of resentment poisons spiritual progress, often leads to emotional enslavement to the hated people and things. An effective way to stay drunk on resentment is to bar hop from anger to self-pity to intolerance to jealousy to fear, then home to an unbelievable hangover and depression. Solution: refuse to let one's serenity be drowned out by happenings that are in themselves unimportant. That's in Odette, page 266. Nobody can hurt our feelings without our permission. A daily step 10 keeps the system clear and the clogged feelings about ourselves and others. Of course, I think there's a lot more to this. It depends on what's going on in your life. And my big resentment was my daughter's perpetrator. I told you that my daughter was leaving an AA dance. She was 3 years sober and I was 4 years sober. A man came up to her and her girlfriend with a gun and kidnapped these two girls. And he beat the other girl unconscious and then brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours. And rape isn't just about sex. It's about terror and it's about violence. And it was so violent, my daughter could not have children. I mean, the things that happened I didn't know could happen. And this man was drinking. He had a bottle of alcohol in his pocket. He drank it throughout the whole ordeal, thank God, because he got quite drunk. And at the point where he's forcing my daughter into the trunk of the car, he somehow got the courage to make an effort to save her own life. And it took her 2 years to remember that she did say a quiet prayer to live. But anyway, he's trying to force her into the trunk of the car, and she just turned around with her elbow and got him in the face. He fell down to the gun slit under the car, and she got away. And the road of recovery was real hard, and it was real long, and it's something that can come up now and then, and it's a struggle. But you cannot force forgiveness. I think all you can do, in things that are this big, we have little resentments, and then we have huge things. In things that are this big, you cannot force forgiveness. I believe all you can do is be willing. Be willing to forgive. If something happens, let it be in God's time. But just have the willingness. But my daughter drank over it. And she would try to get sober, and her sponsor would say, you have to forgive your perpetrator. She'd try and forgive him, she'd get drunk. And this went on and on with about 7 or 8 sponsors. You have to forgive your perpetrator. She'd try to forgive, which is reliving it, and she'd get drunk. And finally, she got a new sponsor who basically said, why don't we just put that on the back burner? You've talked about it enough. We don't need to talk about it anymore. Let's just get you through the steps and get you working with others. And that's basically what he did. He got her through the steps and got her sponsoring people. And then he took her on a panel. She thought she was going to a cider house at Metropolitan State Hospital. But where they went was a locked ward for the criminally insane. And pedophiles, rapists, I mean, everything she's terrified of was locked up in there. And when she realized where she was at, she started to have a panic attack. And they closed those doors and they locked them. But then they started reading the AA readings. And as they read those readings, the fear subsided. And because she was where she was, she did not share about the rape and the kidnap. What she chose to share about was her feelings about God and how God did not take care of her, how God deserted her, all of her feelings about God and all of her prayers and how he was just never there for her. And afterwards, there's 4 people on the panel. All those people that were in the ward, locked ward, lined up to talk to my daughter. And what they talked to her about was their childhoods and their feelings about God and how they prayed for things not to happen. And, I mean, it was really, my daughter just, for the first time, she felt compassion. You know, hurt people hurt people. And when she forgave these gentlemen that are talking to her, she forgave her perpetrator. It just went away. She came home, and honest to God, she looked like she had a facelift. This permanent scowl on her face was gone. She just looked like a different person. And it didn't happen in her time. It happened in God's time, and it was 9 years after the rape. But she was willing. She was willing to forgive. She just couldn't until God brought a situation about that allowed her to forgive. So that's how I feel about forgiveness, is some things you cannot force. Some things are easy and you can just forgive because they're petty. But some things are really big. But the most important key is having the willingness. Just having the willingness in God's time. Jealousy. I had a lot of jealousy. First, I'll read this. It says, a powerful concoction of resentment, fear, self-pity, low self-esteem, and insecurity. Drinking freely and often from jealousy allows one to lose self-control. The mental blend diminishes peace of mind, dangerously threatens faith, and trust in self and others. Jealousy brought into the program hurts the group's unity and fellowship. And we will find a lot of jealousy in this program. And one thing I want to make real clear is the highest you get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober. That's the highest you get. It's not a GSR, it's not a secretary, it's not a speaker, it's not World Service. The highest you get is sober. Recovery. Solution. Recovery is possible through daily attention to spiritual needs. Humility, daily injection disperses the residual effects of jealousy. Step 4 and 5 reveals the exact nature of one's wrongs, of one's compulsion to this green-eyed monster. Step 6 and 7 also wraps this insidious mind bender. So, excuse me. Daily injections of humility. How would we do that? Daily injections of humility. There's lots of different definitions for humility. In the 12 and 12 under step 5, it says, humility is a clear recognition of what and who we are, with a sincere attempt to be all that we can be. And then another definition of humility is being teachable. It's just remaining teachable. And there's another one, and I can't think of it right now. But all of these would be daily injections of humility and giving God the credit. You know, giving God the credit for his grace. A lot of us want to take... we want to take the glory for getting somebody sober. Maybe this was the hardest case anybody worked with, and I got her sober. You know, and it's all about her and her time to get sober and what she's willing to do. It has nothing to do with me. And giving God the credit for all good. It says step 4 and 5 reveals the exact nature of one's compulsion to this green-eyed monster. And another thing I believe about jealousy is I believe if you feel confident about yourself, you feel good about yourself, that jealousy does not exist. And so what we can do is esteemable acts. Things that make us feel good about ourselves. And number one is always working with others. That's the number one thing that is an esteemable act for me that makes me feel good about myself. Other things might be anything you might be doing alcoholically, like food or gambling or things like that, maybe addressing those issues. And you start to feel good about yourself. Exercising, eating right, things that just make you feel good about yourself. Esteemable acts. But the number one esteemable act is being of maximum service to God and your fellows. Dishonesty, self-deception. Emotional intoxicants, which, like champagne, seem harmless, are subtly laced with rationalization and equivocation Indulgence in this pair of defects can cause one to cross over into crippling self-deceit with the greatest ease. Their side effects make us feel sure we are not the maker of our own mischief. We cannot understand why our fringe benefits from the program are not coming to us as we see them coming to others. We cannot give up our secret flirtation with this pair of faults until we are brought painfully to the bottom, facing yet another surrender. Solution: recuperation from the DTs of dishonesty and self-deception requires accepting responsibility for these faults. We must stop manipulating ourselves and others. We must treat the spiritual malady with rigorous honesty. A noticeable change brought about by meticulous application of the 12 steps. In the big book on 58, when it talks about honesty, rigorous honesty, it's talking about self-honesty, which goes along with self-deception. And at 10 years of sobriety, I had reached a point, I had a ninth grade education when I got to this program. And I graduated from high school. I had to go back to high school. They didn't have all this GED classes and stuff. So I had to go back to high school. So I graduated from high school in 1985, and I was 36 years old. And I went back to school. I was working in the musical theater industry, and I was promoted to business manager of this multi-million-dollar corporation. And I am so busy going to school and working this very impressive job. I'm really impressed with myself. But I'm so busy growing in the business world that I don't have time for meetings. I'm so busy growing in the business world, I don't really have time to work with others. And so 2 weeks without a meeting, I had to go to my first event where I had to represent my corporation that I worked for. And it was a birthday party for Debbie Reynolds, her 58th birthday party. I bet none of you even know who Debbie Reynolds is today. Oh, some people do. I mean, when I was young, she was my idol. I loved Debbie Reynolds, and I hated Elizabeth Taylor for taking Eddie Fisher away from her. I just loved her, and she was going to do a show for us called Unsinkable Molly Brown. And so I have to go represent the company at her 58th birthday party. And everybody, there were a lot of stars there, a lot of movie stars there. And none of them were drinking alcoholically. They were all drinking socially. I think if they were drinking alcoholically, it might not have been inviting. But watching all these people socially drink, it was very inviting because, first of all, I was really nervous being there the first time I had to represent the company, and I was ill at ease. And I can't believe how cunning, baffling, and powerful this disease is, because I'm a woman who drank so much vodka down so fast I stopped breathing and had to be rushed to the hospital and brought back to life. But at that party, I got into that stinking thinking, and I started thinking, well, maybe now that I have this education and I have this impressive job, I drive a brand new car and I have this cute house. I didn't have a car for the first 5 years of my sobriety, and I have a cute house, and maybe I'm really not an alcoholic. Maybe I drink because of where I came from. And I talked myself into believing it, the self-deception. And I was there with other people from my job, and I had enough respect for this program. I didn't want to embarrass it by drinking in front of my coworkers. So I put it off, and I had planned to drink the next day. I really planned to drink the next day. And I just think that anybody who had worked those steps as hard as I had worked them, and did as much as I did in the program those first 10 years, I think God had a chance to intervene, because the next day I was asked to pay a 12-step call on a makeup artist. He hadn't shown up at work for 2 weeks. He was held up in a motel. motel's trying to get him out, so they called the executive director, and she asked me to go see what I can do. Thank God for me. I've never had anonymity at work. Never. And it has saved my butt. So anyway, I wasn't happy about this 12-step call she asked me to go on. And I called another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a male, and I asked him to go with me. And we went to this, it was a pretty sleazy motel. And I knocked on this man's door, and he opened that door. Now, if that was me, I would not have opened that door. No way. And I didn't recognize him. He's a makeup artist. And the man standing there is bald. He's profusely sweating. He's swollen. He's so much bigger than I remembered him. He's swollen from the alcohol. He's bleeding from head to toe from falling into things. He smells of alcohol. He smells of urine. And he smells of vomit. And at that point, I was speechless. I didn't even know what to say. But I had an inner voice talk to me, and it was loud and it was clear. Said, Michael, you're not like the people you were with last night. If you drink again, you're standing in front of a mirror. And that man doesn't know it, but he's the one that paid this 12-step call on me. Because that night I got my fanny into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I recommitted to this program. I worked this program harder than I've ever worked it from that time to this time. I know that the longer I'm sober, the easier it is for me to forget where I came from, because I'm used to this way of life. And that's why it's imperative that I'm around newcomers, so they can continually remind me what it's like out there. It's imperative for me to work with newcomers. Okay, let's see what else we got here. Criticism. Mm-hmm. Okay, a social cocktail made with equal parts of a social cocktail made with equal parts of rumor, gossip, and secret glee over others' misfortune. It feels so good to be smugly, it feels so good to smugly say, poor thing. When I moved to the South, I'm really South. I'm right on the border of South Carolina. When I moved to the South, what I noticed when the women started gossiping, they wouldn't say poor thing. They'd say, bless their heart. Honest to God, I'm not exaggerating. Always after they said something nasty about someone, it was bless their heart. The accompanying hors d'oeuvres of self-righteousness is too good to resist. Such behavior hurts and humiliates others and can, especially in the case of newcomers, drive them away. They have come to Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon in good faith and can be driven away believing these programs are not so special after all. Especially when they hear people gossip. They lose faith. You know, they lose faith in ever telling anybody anything. Solution, we need to read the directions on our own prescription. Doesn't it say we should pay attention to our own needs for recovery? The ODAT says on page 92, the contented, well-adjusted person has no need to look for flaws in others. Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon are fellowships of equals. Neither brains, money, looks, prestige, education, cleverness, nor a lack of these kept alcoholics and its effects away from us. Daily cultivate love that looks for nothing in return and meditate on our own good fortune to enjoy the free gifts of God's grace. And these are the times when I find myself being critical of somebody that I'll sit down and I'll look for their good points and I'll write them out. I have an experience with a woman and a man. There is, when I first moved to Georgia, I wasn't real accepted in the Augusta area because I took the only single man. I was from California and I married the only single man. And so there were a few resentments around. And we had a taper there named Leon. I love Leon's pieces. But I was starting to sponsor a lot of women. I mean, I was going out there and assigning myself sponsor. I mean, I'm the one that needs to be sponsoring. I'm dying here. So I'm assigning myself sponsor. So I'm sponsoring a lot of women, and a lot of women started telling me these stories about Leon making passes at him. And so I started to get mad at Leon and very judgmental, and he's my sponsor, my husband's sponsor. And so I remember this one case where I watched him hitting on this girl that I sponsored, and I walked over and I grabbed her and I yanked her and I said, "You stay away from my girls." And so, needless to say, he didn't like me that much, and I didn't like him that much. But as time went by, I really started noticing the good things on Liam, because I would sit down and I'd write him out. And he was a taper, and he would make sure any newcomer had tapes, especially of the big book, and especially if they couldn't read, he'd make sure they had a copy of tapes on the big book. He was not into making money. He was into passing these tapes along. And he central office almost fell apart, and he's the one that pulled it together. Just a lot of really good things about him. And I guess he started noticing things about me, about how I worked. I mean, I work hard with newcomers. And he started really respecting me. In fact, the first workshop I did with my sponsor, I was 20 years sober, and we did a workshop on the 12 steps. He took that, somehow he got hold of it, and he made, for my 20th birthday, he made gold CDs out of the whole set of tapes. They were gold CDs, and it had a beautiful cover over it. And every time he saw me, he'd hug me, and he'd call me Honey Bunch. And so we developed a mutual respect and love for each other. And I went to hear him speak this one night. Gave a great talk, and the next day he died. Now, Sherry is this girl that was Leon's, she thought she was Leon's best friend, I guess, I don't know. But she really hated me. She did not like me. I don't even know why she didn't like me, but she didn't like me. And she would call my husband and make sure I didn't know what was going on. But anyway, she called my husband to tell him that Leon died, and I answered the phone, and she said, "Can I talk to Ted?" And I said, "Sure." Gave Ted the phone. So I found out Leon died. And then the next day when we went to the funeral, Ted and I are standing there, and she's got a big book. Well, first of all, the family called us and asked us if at the funeral we could get alcoholics to get up there and say some funny things about Leon, you know, to kind of lighten up the funeral. And he was being cremated. Well, Sherry's got this big book. She's running around having everybody sign because she's going to put it in the casket with Leon. She had my husband sign it, and then she yanked it away so I couldn't sign it. And when we were sitting in the funeral, we were in the second row, and Sherry and her husband were in the first row. And I wanted to judge her so hard because she, you know, doing all this stuff. But anyway, when they asked for people to come up and share something about Leon, nobody would. I mean, they weren't used to doing that out there, and nobody would. And then one person shared something that was really depressing, and I kept hitting my husband, telling him he had to get up there and share about Leon. And he just couldn't do it. And so I got up there. I was just going to share about the way he calls everyone Honey Bunch and how he passed out tapes to everybody. So I got up there, started to walk up there, and Sherry screamed to the top of her lungs in front of the family and 300 people, "Don't you dare get up there. Leon hated your guts." And I was destroyed. I mean, I was destroyed. You know, it really hurt that she said that in front of all those people. It destroyed me that she did that to the family at his funeral. And I just sat down afterwards. I finished what I was saying, and I sat down afterwards, and I just started crying, and I couldn't stop. And so instead of walking through all the people and walking past her, I went out the back door, and I just went home. And that's the only fight my husband and I ever had. He came in. He was so mad at me for letting that bother me. And I yelled at him, and I said, "I am not an effing guru in AA. I'm a human being. I went and I slammed the door. And anyway, we had to go on a three-week trip. I had to speak 3 weeks in a row, and this is when I had back surgery. So I couldn't sit down. I had to lay down. I could stand and lay down, and so we took our van, and I was going to be gone for 3 weeks. 3 weeks with Sherry in my head. And, I mean, I just couldn't stand it. So I just did what, you know, fancied or real. I wrote Sherry a letter of amends because I needed to be free from this. And I told her all the good things that I did know about her, that she has a gift working with autistic children. She's been a wonderful wife to Chuck, who is Ted's best friend, my husband's best friend, and she was so good to his children, and just everything wonderful I could think about her. And then I said, Sherry, I have no idea what I did to you that makes you hate me so much. And I used the word hate because she used the word hate. And I said, but whatever it is, I am sorry. I've never meant to do anything to hurt you. I am so sorry. And I signed it, and I read it to somebody in Augusta, and I read it to my sponsor before I sent it off, and I sent it off. And nothing ever came of it. Not then. She took it to some people and talked about how stupid it was and all that. And about a year later, at Christmas time, Chuck and Sherry had nowhere to go, and Ted said, can we invite them over? And I said, of course. And so they came over for Christmas, and Sherry said, okay, let's get this over. And we walked into our AA room, and she said, okay, I don't know if we're supposed to make amends, but that letter was really stupid. And I said, Sherry, that letter set me free. And I just walked out. But I'm the one that took the actions of making the amends. And it did set me free. I was able to enjoy the rest of the time and not have her in my head. So sometimes it doesn't matter who's at fault. If you want to be free of it, sometimes we have to take the actions. I think she likes me today, by the way. Sometimes you don't know. She just sometimes will talk to you, sometimes she won't. But I was sitting there in a women's meeting, and she was saying some nice things to the newcomers about me. So I guess I made the great. Depression, a definite emotional downer. Depression plunges one into the abyss of remorse, regret, and rejection. We float around in an eternal hell, unable to sense balance or touch solid ground. Our emotional vision is blurred. We cannot see the helping outstretched hand. Our emotional hearing is dulled. We cannot hear words of encouragement and strength. Our emotional touch is deadened, and we cannot feel love. Our emotional taste is that of isolation and melancholy. Our emotional smell is weakened, and we are unable to perceive the essence of harmony and fellowship. The whole being is so drugged by depression that realistic contact with self in others is suspended. And I'm not a person who comes from depression. So I've never really felt depression like some of my sponsees have. And my sponsors suffer terrible depression until I went into menopause. And all I can say is menopause, what an order. My husband just can't go through with it. I mean, I sunk into, and I had just moved to Augusta, Georgia, and I come from 300 people in my home group, and my home group in Evans was 10 people, and I was the only woman. And, you know, they say you'll create the fellowship you crave, which I did, but first I had to go through this major depression. I went to a doctor, and it was listed as major depression. And it was ugly, and it was dark. And I felt like I had clouds in my head. I mean, I couldn't see the sunlight. It was so dark. And I cannot tell you how thankful I am that I had that experience, because I couldn't identify it. I couldn't identify and I couldn't really understand how awful depression is until I experienced it. I needed to experience it. Huge daily doses of attitude of gratitude. This is a solution. We need a willingness to surrender this unique pain. Sobriety follows quickly when one can be grateful for pain rather than struggling with it. And I did find the ability to be grateful for it. Thanking God for pain relapses it back into His care. We are saying that we realize we are not perfect enough to manage all of our affairs, and that we recognize also that His principles provide us with protection and guidance. Gratitude brings release. Release brings experience. Experience brings hope. Hope brings faith. Faith brings freedom from fear. A spiritual awakening takes place. A rebirth occurs, and one is never the same. And that has been my experience. And what I did to create the fellowship that I craved, I went to a place called the Hope House. And I started working with all the women there. And then eventually they sold the Hope House. The government got involved. And so it was no longer for drugs. It was for homeless people. And so I had to seek out something else. And I was asked to do a first step meeting at Fort Gordon. We have a detox there for drunken soldiers. And they asked me to do a first step meeting there. And sharing with the soldiers and talking with the soldiers, I knew they didn't understand the 12 steps. They thought an autobiography was a fourth step. They thought confronting their parents was a step 9. And so I asked the counselors up there if I could possibly have them come to my home for a meeting and a barbecue on Wednesdays. And they said yes. I mean, all I had to do is ask, and they said yes. And so for 19 years, I have had 30 soldiers in my AA room, brand newcomers that have kept me sober through the good and the bad. And I feel like I owe them so much. They just can't believe I opened my home to them. They just don't get it. You know, they just don't understand how desperate I was to have them to work with. And a lot of these, in fact, where's Anna? Everybody knows Anna Airplane. Anna was one of my soldiers. She was one of my soldiers. Now she's been my good friend and sponsee for 12 years. It's been a gift beyond my wildest dreams, and that they still let them come. They've let me take them to conventions in other states. You don't hear of that. That doesn't happen. They've let me take the women to women's retreats. It's been an awesome experience. I want to tell you this one experience that we had. We were on step 2. We used to have to go pick them up. All these soldiers get all these cars together. We were on step 2, and this man jumped up and he started cussing out God. And I had just had surgery. I mean, I just had back surgery. I just got home Wednesday morning and I thought I wasn't going to meet with him. One of my favorite pages in the big book is the bottom of 14, top of 15. It says, "For if an alcoholic failed to perfect in the larger spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive those certain trials and low spots ahead." That tells me two things. It tells me, first of all, if I'm not working with others, I fail to grow spiritually. I can pray, I can meditate, I can go to church, but if I'm not helping anybody, I'm no earthly good. And the only way I'm going to survive trials and low spots, which back surgeries was definitely one, was working with others. And so I decided to show up that night. So anyway, we're on step 2. And what I would do with them back then, because they all came in at once and left at once, it's different now. But we'd go over just the God shots of the history. We'd do step 1 out of the big book, step 2, step 3 out of the big book, and I'd show them how to do a fourth step and try and help them get sponsors, because I knew a lot of people in different states. And anyway, this one gentleman, he was sitting right next to me, got up and started screaming and cussing out God and blah, 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 blah. And I could feel spit on my face. He was so angry. And so the other soldiers got hold of him and kind of forced him down in his chair. And the last thing he said when he sat down is, if there's a God, it's going to take a burning bush to prove it to me. And if I first, when I first told the story, I would say, my first thought was, oh God, I'm out of burning bushes. But that's not the truth. My first thought was, I can't believe I got out of bed for this crap. That was my first thought. But anyway, I asked him what his name was. He said his name was Lee. So that just reminded me of another man named Lee, who wrote me a letter 2 years after he had a spiritual experience at one of my talks, and it had nothing to do with me. If it wasn't me, it would have been another speaker. It had everything to do with where he was sitting. He was the first man in the auditorium. He wasn't even registered for the conference, and he was trying to make up his mind whether to commit suicide or drink again. And he wrote that the whole time I was sharing my story, he didn't hear a word I said. He just looked down at his feet the whole time. But I closed my story with how I came to terms with the God I have in my life. And that was through the tragedy of my daughter being kidnapped. And he said, when I got to the part of saying that God is good and good is God, he said this force that he couldn't explain pushed his chin up. No matter what he did, he couldn't keep his head down. This force pushed his chin up and made him look straight at the speaker. And on the above the speaker was a great big neon light. It was Mardi Gras colors, and it was it said Jubilee, because it was called Gulf Shores Jubilee. It had two camels on the end, and so he looked up at me, the speaker, who is saying God is good and good is God. And the first thing he saw when I said that was his name, Lee, because my body was blocking the part that said Juba. He couldn't see that. All he could see was his name, Lee. So it's like I'm saying, God is good, good is God. Lee, I'm talking to you. But he thought. And he said that he didn't know, but that was his spiritual experience. And that's when his life started to change. And he didn't have to drink. And so I was sharing that story with this group of soldiers that's sitting in my AA room. This is the honest God truth. I don't see anything around here that looks like. We have a couch, and we have two bushy bushes on both sides of the couch. And we have to move everything to get all these guys in the room. So someone shoved the bush that was on this side of me right into a corner where there was a halogen lamp. Honest to God truth. I'm saying, and it was dusty. The bush was dusty, too, so I'm saying God is good, good is God. The halogen lamp caught on fire and the bush caught on fire. Poof! I mean, my house is on fire. I'm not even remembering him demanding a burning bush. I am freaking out. And all the soldiers got into action. He just screamed O-S-H-I-T and ran out of the house. And all the soldiers got busy, and they got the bush out, and they got the lamp out. They brought fans in and started blowing the smoke out. And then when we all sat down again, it wasn't until my feet hit the chair that I got it. You know, I just remember thinking, oh, my God, this man demanded a burning bush, and God delivered it. And it was not just a spiritual experience for him. It was a spiritual experience for me and all the other soldiers. I didn't feel my pain, didn't feel my stitches. I didn't have to take any pain medication. Those guys were so transformed when they went back to the when they went back to the treatment center. The treatment center was so impressed that they started bussing them over to my house. I used to have to go pick them up, and now they're being delivered to me. And this is a big white bus that looks like a prison bus on the highway. I mean, I was not expecting a prison bus to be delivering them. I heard this awful noise. I looked out the window, and I went, oh, my God, here's this big, huge white bus. It goes all the way. I live on a little cul-de-sac to the end of the cul-de-sac, circles around and comes back and stops in front of my house, and they're not in uniform. So they all get off, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, what are my neighbors thinking? I just know that if that had been me, and that was happening across the street, I would go over and say, do I need to lock my doors and bar my windows? I just didn't know how I was going to handle it if anybody asked me. And it came, that white bus came for 8 years. Now they're bringing them in three little vans. I think they heard my talk. But it's been a godsend. It's just been an absolute godsend. And these are the things I get to experience because I choose to suit up and show up. And there's always something amazing waiting around the corner. And I have a lot of trials and tribulations. I really do. My daughter is dying of liver disease. It's fatty liver disease. And my husband's son was killed in a tragic accident. And we had, these grandkids are running rapid. You know, it's just things happen. You know, those things happen. And what gets me through them is I throw myself into this program. And somehow they always work themselves out. I can't wait to see how God works out this one with my granddaughter. She is just over the top. Yeah, is it time? Great.